Welcome to Catholic Answers Live, the program where you participate with your questions about apologetics and evangelization, including the most important theological, spiritual, moral, and social issues facing the world today. Call now with your question for today's guest, toll free, 1-888-31-TRUTH. That's 888-318-7884. Now, from San Diego, Catholic Answers Live.
Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. Cy Kellett here with you. Open forum today, as promised. Open forum, 2 hours today, although a little change in the schedule due to Hurricane Irma. Actually, it's got nothing to do with Hurricane Irma, but I feel like you're going to be able to blame anything on that for the next few months. If anything goes, oh, I couldn't make it to lunch, Hurricane Irma. Probably shouldn't joke about that. On the West Coast, it feels less serious. But our schedule change was first hour, we were supposed to have Tim Staples. Second hour, Patrick Madrid. We'll just switch that. So we have Patrick Madrid with us this hour. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, Cy. Thanks for having me in here. Kind of a switcheroo at the last minute, but thank you.
Yeah, no, it's great to have you. Patrick, as many will know, the host of the Patrick Madrid Show on Immaculate Heart Radio, also the author of many books. Am I right to say most recently Surprised by Life, or has another one come out since then?
Yeah, that is the most recent book, Surprised by Life, published by Sophia Institute Press. There are a couple more in the pipeline coming out soon, yeah. But that's the latest one.
And I know you laugh because I sometimes tease you about the fact that if I turn around, then another book will come out. If I don't keep my eyes on you, another book will come out. But Surprised by Truth, I hope did very well. The whole Surprised by Life, the whole Surprised by Truth, I think is that true? Do you think that that's the one you're most known for editing and producing, the Surprised by Truth?
Well, I think maybe originally that was probably true, but that's going back now nearly 25 years. So I don't think so anymore, but certainly for a long stretch, the Surprised by Truth book, a lot of people had never heard of me, but they had heard of the book.
Oh, right.
Which is fine.
Yeah.
So that's fine with me.
Right. It's a story of people's conversions, or it's a book of conversion stories, which have meant a lot to people over the years. Let me give out the number, 888-318-7884, our number, 888-31-TRUTH. Any question you have on any aspect of Catholic life, faith, or history, and also you don't have to be Catholic to call. We welcome any caller today for open forum, 888-318-7884. Patrick, I'm reading the news and the words motu proprio come up.
Mm-hmm.
The Pope giving us a motu proprio, I think it was yesterday, may have been the day before yesterday. I don't know how the clocks all work with Rome time and everything, but can you tell me what a motu proprio is, and is this one what's interesting about this one?
Sure. Well, a motu, the phrase, that's a Latin phrase, motu proprio, it means on his own initiative or on his own doing. And that refers to the Holy Father, the Pope, who, as this, we in the Catholic Church refer to this as the supreme legislator, meaning that he can amend canon law. He doesn't require a council or anybody else to approve it. He can just simply make changes. So a motu proprio, under his own will or his own volition, a pope can I was tempted to say impose, but that's not really the right word, but a pope can promulgate, might be a good word for it.
Yeah,
not in the sense of promulgating a dogma or anything like that, but he can promulgate a new course of action in a particular area. And so most recently, perhaps the more famous version of this under Pope Benedict XVI was when he issued a motu proprio that made it very clear that the traditional Latin Mass, or the extraordinary form of the Mass as it's called, that it is free to be celebrated by any priest anywhere. He doesn't need special permission. Parishes that have people in a certain number of people in a group who ask for the traditional Mass to be celebrated, that should be granted if at all possible. So it was a way for Pope Benedict XVI to emphasize that the traditional Latin Mass had not been abrogated, and it was still, you know, it was a very good thing to celebrate that Mass for those who want it. Now, it doesn't replace the new Mass, nothing at all like that, but it cleared up a lot of ambiguity, and it also emphasized his will as pontiff that this should go in that direction. So that's, in essence, what a motu proprio is. Now, you're referring to the motu proprio that was issued by Pope Francis, I presume. Is that right?
Yes, yeah, just in the last couple of days.
Well, that too has to do with the liturgy, and it involves liturgical texts that are, and keep in mind that liturgical texts extend beyond simply the Roman Missal, the Mass, the prayers that we use at Mass. It would also extend to other things, including the celebration of the sacraments, most specifically, if I can get the words out of my mouth. And so in this motu proprio, what he did was he relegated the authority to approve translations to the bishops' conferences. In other words, he's moving the authority to do this back to the bishops at a more local level. The Congregation for Sacred Texts at the Vatican, I believe, as I understand it, still has kind of a final oversee, and they can give a thumbs up or a thumbs down. But far more latitude is now being granted to the different bishops' conferences of the various countries around the world. So
I see.
In a nutshell, that's my understanding of the new motu proprio.
Well, that kind of fits with the general direction of Pope Francis to decentralize, to push things out to the periphery, but he uses that word differently, but to push things out to the more local level.
Yes. Now, I myself have not had much time to really study this, so I'm by no means an expert on this topic. I can only tell you from my cursory looking at this what I understand it to be. But maybe a canon lawyer would be in a better position to answer the more precise details. But that's, you know, that's something new, and we're going to see how that works out.
If I could just ask you real quick before we go to calls, Patrick, about how common is this? I mean, it seems like, well, the last one, roughly, Pope Benedict, but is it every 100 years or every 5 or 6 years we get one of these? Or?
No, it's more frequent than that. In the political world in the United States, we've become accustomed to things called executive orders where the president,
right,
without, you know, recourse to the Congress or without recourse to the courts or anything, can simply mandate something. And this is not exactly the same thing, but there is a kind of parallel to that where the Pope has that freedom and that authority to say, this is something we're going to be doing in this area. And he can issue a motu proprio, and then we do that. So it's far more frequent than every 100 years. In fact, I can't think of any Pope in the last century who hasn't issued motu proprios, and in some cases several. So it's more common than that.
All righty. You feel ready to go to calls, Patrick?
I think so, yeah.
All right. You sound like it. You sound like you're ready to go.
Good.
Rodney in Norfolk, Nebraska, listening on 88.3 FM. Rodney, your question for Patrick Madrid.
Hi. Why was the Sabbath commandment abrogated when in the last chapter of Isaiah, verses 22 and 23, it states, "As the new heavens and the new earth I'm going to make will stand before me, says Yahweh, then the first of every month and every Sabbath, all mankind will come to worship before me, says Yahweh."
So the question, Rodney, then is... Okay, go ahead, sorry.
If the Sabbath worship is going to be held in the new heavens and earth for eternity, why would it have been abrogated?
Okay, good question. Now, it wasn't abrogated per se. It was the observance of that commandment was transferred from being observed on Sunday or Saturday to Sunday, so from the seventh day of the week to the first day of the week, reckoning according to the Jewish calendar. And that is because Jesus in himself, he fulfilled all the requirements of the law, and he has the authority and granted the authority to the church to bind and loose. A good example that is kind of a parallel to this is how when the scribes and Pharisees and the Jewish leaders rebuked Jesus because he and his disciples were picking grain on the Sabbath day, and of course one of the Ten Commandments is thou shalt keep holy the Sabbath, and it was understood to include you can't do any work, etc. So he reminded them that man was not made for the Sabbath was made for man, and that he, as the Son of God, has authority over the Sabbath. And that authority he granted to his apostles in places like Matthew chapter 16, verse 18, where he said to Peter, "Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, whatever you loose on earth will be loose in heaven." He says the same thing corporately to all the apostles two chapters later in Matthew chapter 18, verse 18. Or in Luke 10:16, he says to the apostles, "He who listens to you listens to me. So there are a series of different emphatic references to this authority to bind and loose and to modify things as necessary given by Jesus. So that's the underlying reason that the church recognized that, number one, to show its distinction between the Old Testament covenant, the ceremonial law of Moses, and the new law, the new covenant of Jesus Christ. Also to demonstrate that we worship together on the day that Jesus rose from the dead. This is the Lord's Day, the early church recognized. And so that's the reason behind it. That's the logic behind it, and that's the biblical basis for it.
Okay, Rodney?
Be reinstated for eternity in the new heavens and the new earth.
Right, but you have to understand that the term Sabbath in this case, with regard to the new heavens and the new earth, doesn't necessarily mean, in an absolute sense, the seventh day of the week. Keep in mind that when the calendars changed, actually they changed two major times, from the lunar calendar used by the Jews to a solar calendar, and it was revised by Pope Gregory, the shift in days actually means that the day that is celebrated as the Sabbath, according to the lunar calendar, would not be the same day according to the solar calendar. Now, that's only kind of a footnote in the bigger picture, that things have changed somewhat over the centuries, including the day on which we celebrate the Sabbath. But the new heavens and the new earth are not going to be reverting back to the Jewish Mosaic ceremonial version of this, but according to the church. And let me give you a second thought here, just as a way of thinking about this. In Genesis chapter 17, God gives Abraham the covenant, the commandment of circumcision. And I would encourage you to go back and read this all the way through. And he says in chapter 17, verse 2, he says, "Between you and me, I will establish my covenant." And he goes on to describe this covenant between him and his people, and the covenant would be demonstrated through circumcision. And he says in verse 9, "On your part, you and your descendants after you must keep my covenant throughout the ages. This is my covenant with you and your descendants after you, that you must keep every male among you must be circumcised." He says in verse 13, "Thus my covenant shall be in your flesh as an everlasting pact. If a male is uncircumcised, that is, if the flesh of his foreskin has not been cut away, such a one will have been cut off from his people. He has broken my covenant." And this emphasis on the eternal nature of the covenant is repeated. But notice that the church has the authority and exercise that authority to abrogate the actual circumcision as the ordinance and it replaced it, you might say, or transferred it to baptism. So it's still observed, but not in the same form. And in a way similar to that, we see the church transferring the observance from the Sabbath day on Saturday to the first day of the week on Sunday.
I hope that is helpful to you, Rodney. We have to take a quick break. Open Forum today, Patrick Madrid, our guest. Any question you have on the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church, welcome. 888-318-7884 is our number. We'll be right back after this on Catholic Answers Live.
Call now, Catholic Answers Live.
Are you coming to the Catholic Answers Conference this September?
You guys put on a great show, so it's well worth coming.
Very powerful, very motivational and moving.
I think it's awesome. It's been really amazing to get to know people from all across the country.
Every time somebody's speaker finishes, I feel like I want to cry just because of how happy I am.
It's been pretty phenomenal. Very educational, enlightening.
This year's conference is September 28th through the 30th here in beautiful San Diego, and we want to see you there. Seats are still available, but act now because they are going fast. Call us today at 1-888-291-8000 or visit CatholicAnswersConference.com now and reserve your spot.
This is where it starts, and it definitely has started for me.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The Catholic Answers Minute. I'm Father Vincent Serpa. In Luke 6:12, Jesus went to a mountain to pray, spending the night in communion with his Father. At daybreak, he selected 12 disciples to be his apostles. Mentioning Simon Peter first, the gospel is clear that his choices were specific and deliberate. Coming down the mountain with them, he exposed them to a large crowd of people who were in need. He deliberately went from a night of prayer to hand-picking apostles to immersing them in the crowds who needed them. Note that he preceded all important events with prayer and fasting. This is how the church came about, and it's how it continues. How many times did we see Pope John Paul praying everywhere, on planes, in chapels, or standing and leaning his head against the crucifix on his staff? Prayer is simply a matter of speaking from the heart and listening as well. Often there are no words. It's just a matter of letting the soul breathe. I'm Father Vincent Serpa for Catholic Answers, Catholic.com.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
And welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. So happy that you're here with us for Open Forum today. Lines fill up so quickly on Open Forum Day, especially when Patrick Madrid is here with us and Tim Staples following. Are you kidding? But we are able to take your call, and you just hang on and we'll get to it. So give us a call, 888-318-7884. Patrick Madrid, host of the Patrick Madrid Show, also author of so many things. I thought about this, Patrick. Search and Rescue, that's another one. That's a one people know you for. Michael in Sacramento, California, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. You are on with Patrick Madrid. What's your question?
Hola, Saint Patrick.
Saint Patrick.
Hey, hola. Yes.
Buenas tardes.
I am a regular listener and occasional caller to your morning show, and I'm ever so delighted to find you in the afternoon.
Well, thank you. I appreciate
when, that. Refresh me on the chapter and verse. I want to say it's 2 Corinthians, where St. Paul describes a man esteeming one day over another, and others esteem every day the same.
It could be. I'd have to look it up to double check. It sounds also reminiscent of what St. Paul says in the Epistle to the Galatians, where he says, "Let no one look down upon you for, you know, with regard to new moons and feast days and Sabbath days and things like that." There, he's referring to our freedom in Christ. So, without double checking, that sounds about right. But I don't know the exact verse.
That much being said, how is it then that we experience a holy day of obligation?
Okay, how do we experience a holy day of obligation? When what? When it says that we shouldn't esteem one day over the other?
Right. What is a holy day of obligation?
Okay. I think I see maybe what you're driving at. It actually goes to the issue that our previous caller was raising with regard to the Sabbath observance. And so the emphasis on it's got to be on this specific day in the old law, under the Mosaic ceremonial law, was because this was the literal understanding, the literal meaning of the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20, where God enjoins upon his people that they have to keep holy the Sabbath being the seventh day. So that specific day was extremely important. It remains important, but as I mentioned to that earlier caller, the church has the authority to transfer the observance of that commandment from one day to the next for the reasons I mentioned. So St. Paul's emphasis there is on people who are still kind of stuck in the Mosaic covenant. They haven't realized that they are now free to, not free in an absolute sense, because you're not free to do things that would be immoral, but the church now has relaxed certain things, like no more actual circumcision, now it's baptism, things of that nature. So that's one part of the answer. The second part of the answer would be that the church still has the prerogative to emphasize that certain days of the year, certain feast days that are associated with martyrs or events in the church that are very important, that those are obligatory for us in terms of attending Mass, participating at Mass, because of their solemnity. So this falls under that earlier rubric that I mentioned with regard to binding and loosing. The church doesn't lose its authority to bind and loose simply because we're in the new covenant. It actually gains an authority that wasn't there before. And so that's why the church says we have a holy day of obligation on August 15th, the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary, or on December the 8th, the feast of her Immaculate Conception, that kind of thing. I'm not sure if that hits the bullseye on the target for you, but if there's more to it I can explain, just let me know.
Well, I understand what you're saying, and personally, I have no problem. It's just that when I'm talking with Protestants who say, well, wait a minute, how can you acknowledge a holy day of obligation when St. Paul clearly stated that let each man, it's not exactly do what's right in his own eyes, because of course nobody wants that, but it's more at the sense of obligation toward an act of faith. So I think you've answered it, but I'm still not clear as to how I would answer that question to somebody who's not Catholic.
I hear you, and I want to do a better job then if I didn't answer it well the first time. Think about a family dinner, and mom and dad say to their kids, every weekday we're going to have dinner together as a family. Let's just make it easy. Let's just say every Wednesday we're going to have a family dinner. We know everybody's busy and dad's working and all that, but on Wednesdays we're going to all have dinner together at 6 p.m., and you all have to be here for that because that's going to be something for family building. It doesn't matter whether dinner is at 7 or 5 or 5:30. I mean, that's immaterial. What matters is that the mom and dad have said, this is important for the family, and we want everybody to be here at this particular time. That's where the importance comes in. So the point that St. Paul makes there about not being partial to one day or the other, that's kind of an expression of the general freedom that we have that is contrasted with the kind of lockstep, and maybe that's not the right word for it, the kind of rigorous observance of very minute rules under the Mosaic Covenant. Certain dishes can't touch other dishes that have had this kind of food, dairy versus meat, that kind of thing. All of the meticulously detailed and very rigorous observances of the law, those things we are freed from in Jesus. And now we're not freed in an absolute sense. There are still things that we are obliged to do. And so we recognize that the church has this authority given to it by Jesus to say, kind of like mom and dad saying, every Wednesday night we're going to have dinner at 6. We have that obligation because the church is our mother, and the church is there to not only guide us to heaven, but also to help us be better Christians in this life. So when it comes to a holy day of obligation, which would be similar to the church's proclamation of our Sunday obligation, we do have an obligation to do that, not because we're bound to that old Mosaic law, and it's not legalism, but because this is family business. And as a family, we are called to join together at certain times. I guess that's another way to express the same point. I hope that's a little more helpful.
Okay, Michael?
Yes, thank you.
Thanks, Michael.
Thank you.
Appreciate that call.
Thanks, Michael.
888-318-7884. The number, open forum today. We'll go to Joseph in San Mateo, California, listening on Immaculate Radio. And Joseph, we'll try to go as quickly as we can, but part of the answer may have to come after the break. What's your question for Patrick Madrid, Joseph?
Yes, my question has to do with the Medjugorje apparition. From what I understand, the church has not come to a conclusion about it. Is that correct?
That's correct.
If the church decides or concludes that this is not from God, is there the possibility that throughout all this time, this has been a demon impersonating the Blessed Mother?
If the church decides that this is not an authentic apparition, then that is a possibility. I don't know that that's a likelihood, but it's a possibility. It could also be, if indeed the church were to determine it this way, it could also be attributed to the personalities and imagination of the men and women who are considered seers, quote-unquote. That's another possibility. But the demonic is a possibility. Yes.
Okay. It just makes me shudder that if it comes to that, that people have been exposing themselves to the doctrine of demons through all this time.
Well, thankfully, we have the church to guide us in this issue, and I don't have any say in the matter one way or the other. I'm just simply acknowledging that that could be one way of explaining it if, in fact, the church were to determine that it's not authentic, although it has not done that.
Joseph, thank you for that call. You did do that really quick, Joseph, and so did you, Patrick, which means we can take more calls when we come back on the other side. Open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. We'll be right back after this.
Listeners to Catholic Radio, I think, benefit most, at least initially, from what I call remedial catechesis. What Catholic Radio does is it becomes an echo chamber for the teaching authority of the Catholic Church. And what we're doing is teaching many things which have been neglected over the last 40, 50 years. If you listen to Catholic Radio, you know what the Catholic Church teaches.
Al Cresta thinks Catholic Radio is important. So should you.
Hello, my friends. This is Catholic Answers President Christopher Check, and I'm here to tell you about a unique resource just out from Catholic Answers Press. One of the ways Jesus answered his critics was to use their own words against them, showing how even the enemies of the faith admitted crucial facts that undermined their own positions. And it's been that way through the ages. It's proved impossible for those out to destroy the faith to mount their attacks without tripping themselves up and inadvertently testifying to the truth of what they're trying to destroy. In his new book, Hostile Witnesses, How the Historic Enemies of the Church Prove Christianity, renowned author Gary Machuda looks at dozens of Christianity's most notorious foes from biblical times to the present day and draws from their antagonistic words and deeds surprising testimony to gospel truths. Rich in research and written with clarity and force, Hostile Witnesses is a unique contribution to Catholic apologetics and one that speaks with special urgency to a modern world in which the faith is under attack like never before. If you love apologetics, you need to order your copy of Hostile Witnesses today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at catholic.com, or asking for this book at a Catholic bookstore in your area.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. We pulled the old switcheroo on you today. If you were expecting Patrick Madrid second hour, we've got him first hour. And same with Tim. If you were expecting Tim Staples first hour, we've got him second hour. But both hours open for him. And you are more than welcome to call with any question you have about us Catholics, how we worship, what we do, what we believe, what we don't do, and what we don't believe. 888-318-7884, the number. I do want to stress you do not have to be Catholic to call. Anybody can call with any question. And I think even we would welcome challenges. If you have some challenge for us, we're happy to address that. 888-318-7884. And now we go to Mike in Kauai, if I'm reading that correctly. Kauai, Hawaii, listening on EWTN. Did I get that right, Mike?
Yes, you did. How are you doing?
Very well. You are on with Patrick Madrid. What's your question?
Okay. I'm curious about all these tornadoes and storms and tsunamis and everything hitting everywhere. And it's usually in places where there's quite a bit of evil going on. So my question is, where in the Bible does it say that God uses those types of things for punishment? And then I got a follow-up statement afterwards.
Well, I don't know. This is Patrick Madrid here. I don't know a specific verse that says God does that. I know that that does happen. I mean, you can go back to the book of Genesis in Genesis 19 and take a look at what happened with Sodom and Gomorrah. So there's a great example of probably the worst storm you could imagine because it involved fire and brimstone and it wiped out two cities. So the idea or the concept of this is certainly biblical, no doubt about that. But I think more to the point, if you're looking at current events and the current spate of hurricanes and the earthquakes and things like that, keeping in mind that there have always been hurricanes and there have always been earthquakes, at least in modern history, this is a natural phenomenon that you can see being caused by the forces of nature, by wind and rain and precipitation and all those things. But I think the deeper question is it possible that God may in fact be using these natural phenomena as a way to chastise his people? The answer to that question is certainly yes. It is indeed possible, and there is biblical precedent for that happening. But whether or not these specific hurricanes and these specific earthquakes and such, whether or not these are directly permitted by God or even sent by God, I don't know. And only God would know that. So I think we should see in them, as Jesus says several times in the Gospels, he says to watch and pray and to see the signs of the times. Jesus says, when you feel a hot wind coming from the south, you know that the summer is near. That's the Scirocco wind that would come up from the from Africa. He pointed out when you see buds coming out on trees that you know that spring is near, that kind of thing. So I think that whether it's something like a hurricane or a tsunami, we can, on the one hand, acknowledge that these are purely natural phenomena, which they are, but at the same time, we can be watching and seeing to see whether or not there is a prophetic and theologically rich, that's not right, not quite the right word, prophetic and, let's say, spiritual dimension to that, because that's certainly possible as well.
Here's the main reason why I called. I was living in Key West about 6 years ago, and I was seeing all the homosexuality, lesbianism, guys walking around growing breasts, men being changed into, you know, into women, and it was just horrible. And then all the illegals flooding in and the drugs, it was just, it was ridiculous. And everybody's doing everything right in plain sight. So, you know, I asked God, you know, well, I what's going on with this? What, you know, what are we going to do about this? Well, anyway, he inspires me on Facebook to warn the island of Key West that if they did not stop the evils that they were doing, that God would send a tsunami with the next hurricane that he sent.
Okay, Mike, hang on a sec. Hang on a sec. So, you felt compelled to warn people about this, and now I'm guessing you're saying that that warning has come true.
6 years almost to the day.
Okay, so I don't, Patrick, I don't know how you want to respond to that.
Yeah. Well, first of all, there was no tsunami. We know that much for sure. Key West got battered by the hurricane. It's not the first time that that happened. So I don't really think that there's any connection because there was no tsunami. So if that's what you were told or that's what you think you heard, it didn't happen, at least not with this latest hurricane. There was no tsunami in Key West. There was no tsunami that hit Florida. Didn't happen.
What do you call that big wall of water that washed over the islands?
It's called a storm surge.
10 feet tall.
Okay, yeah, it's called a storm surge.
There's a type of tsunami. If you look up tsunami, there's more than one type of tsunami. So anyway, it did happen just the way God said, 6 years to the day, and probably about 15 years ago.
Mike, hang on a second again. Sai here. I'm very careful about the claim that God has spoken to anyone when that person makes that claim, and I leave it entirely in the church's hands to evaluate that. And so, having no knowledge of that whatsoever, I think we'll move on. It is important always to remember that the mercy of God is pouring out constantly, and so I'm with Patrick that God does indeed punish us, and sometimes in very helpful ways that move us forward. But I have a lack of conviction about sharing these personal revelations that God made because
alleged personal revelations.
Right,
if I
right.
can end that.
Thank you, Patrick. And so we'll move on, and I hope we part friends. Thanks very much, Mike. We go now to Eric in Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WLCR Radio. Eric, your question for Patrick Madrid.
Hi, guys. I got a quick question. It's about, in Acts of the Apostles, there's this girl who's chasing, I think it's Paul, around and bugging him. Which she's possessed by a spirit of divination. And so finally he has enough of that, and he tells the spirit to go away, and then everybody is mad at him, and all sorts of chaos ensues. And so I'm wondering, what's that all about?
Mm-hmm.
And then next, did Paul make a mistake? And third, is that a good spirit or a bad spirit? That's my question.
Okay. Well, first of all, the incident happens in Acts chapter 16, and it says that when she and her household had been baptized, she urged us, "If you consider me a believer in the Lord, come and stay at my house." And she persuaded us. One day, as we were going to the place of prayer, we were met by a slave girl with a spirit of clairvoyance who earned a large income for her masters by fortune-telling. The girl followed Paul and the rest of us, shouting, "These men are servants of the Most High God who are proclaiming to you a way of salvation." So that's the context of this passage. The clue that this is not a good spirit is that she was fortune-telling, and she was using this spirit, or the spirit was using her, as the case may be, to make a lot of money. So that's what was going on. It definitely was not anything from the Holy Spirit, nothing compatible with Christianity. And she was harassing them and pestering them. So that's why Paul rebuked her and sent that spirit away. That's what's going on there.
Gotcha. Okay. That answers that question. Thank you.
Awesome.
Thanks, Eric. 888-318-7884, the number. As I said, the lines do tend to keep filling up quickly. So if you have a question for Patrick Madrid, give us a call, 888-318-7884. Open forum today. We go now to Gisela in Mission Viejo, listening on Immaculate Heart Radio. Gisela, your question, I hope I got the name right, or is it Gisela?
Yeah, you did it. It's a German name. Okay. And I'm from Mission Viejo, St. Kilian's Church. Patrick knows the church very well.
I know it well, yes.
And last time you were here, you passed through and went to your favorite chicken place. And then you got me interested.
Are you tracking my movements?
You have something on his phone?
You said that on the radio, and so then I decided, I must go try it out. And it's so good, now I'm there quite a bit.
He's not just an apologist, he's also a culinary expert. It's amazing, Patrick.
Well, when I tell you the name of the place, you may not be quite as impressed. I love El Pollo Loco. I just love it.
Yes, I know you do. You said that.
Oh, my gosh. That green sauce... I will drink that by the gallon. So whenever I have a chance, that's where I like to go. That and In-N-Out Burger. So there's my secret.
I went by there and I said, I must try it. Patrick said it's good. And by golly, it's good.
Oh, good. I'm glad you liked it.
I met you with my friends in San Juan Capistrano High School, where your daughter works as a teacher.
And oh, we sort of remember actually, that's my sister. That's a compliment to her. You made me a lot older right there.
Yeah, oh, she was a very useful looking lady, yes. But yes. Anyway, I'm so glad I'm going to talk to you. And my question actually
is, do you happen to have my social security number?
I know, really? How's your life? Is your life locked up?
I'm wondering what else
Patrick?
You know about me.
I listen. I'm listening to the radio a lot. My husband passed away 5 years ago, and so the radio is my my everything now. I mean, when I'm not in church every day, I'm listening to my radio morning from in front of the house and the back of the house. It's just my savior, you know, and I'm learning a lot because I'm a convert, you know. So
Wonderful.
I'm very grateful for Catholic radio station.
So, and your question, Gisela, for Patrick.
My question is, and I belong to a prayer group for over 20 years, and we had a little discussion recently because I came up with a prayer that I found in the church, St. Kilian's, the 15 secret tortures of our Lord Jesus Christ. Are you familiar with those, Patrick?
I've read them. In fact, I wonder if they might be in the blue Pietà booklet, the little prayer booklet, because I'm thinking that that might be where they're contained. I have read them. I am familiar with them, yes.
Yeah, not in the Pietà, because I use the Pietà every day. But you know what? We had a discussion that most of my friends don't believe they're true because they're so severe. So I'm saying it now for a few months, not knowing if they're true or not. And then I said, the only person I would know is Patrick. I'm going to call. But this first time I had guts to call. So you don't. Can you remember how serious they were? And how? I mean, they really, anybody would wonder how the Lord was ever able to carry his cross after going through this.
Well, as you were asking me the question, I just pulled them up in front of me now. So I've got them. I remember them from reading them a long time ago, but now I'm seeing them. So this list says they fastened my feet with a rope and dragged me over the stepping stones of the staircase down into a filthy, nauseating cellar. They took off my clothing and stung my body with iron joints. They attached a rope around my body and pulled me on the ground from end to end. All of these things, including the whipping and the crown of thorns and standing barefoot on the hot stones and things, all of these seem to me to be consistent with what we see described in the Gospels, although not in that specificity. But they do seem to comport with the general effort to torture Jesus by whipping him, by crowning him with thorns, by the cloak that was adhering to the wounds on his body being torn away from him, not to mention the nails that were hammered into his hands and feet. So I have no way of knowing whether or not these things actually happened. My understanding is that the church has approved this as a devotion to really focus on the wounds and the passion of Jesus. But beyond that, I couldn't say that this one is in this verse of the Bible or anything like that. I think just generally they seem to fit with the overall picture of the way they tortured Jesus.
Not as bad as some of the other stuff that he'd gone through. And it links, just thinking of it links tears to my eyes, but it's just absolutely horrible that he was able to carry our sins afterwards up to Calvary. But then I thought, well, perhaps you would know. And I just continue saying them, I suppose. It's just, you say those, you read one every day and say the prayer on the back, and then you leave it at that. But the Lord promises, of course, to give you a grace for that as well.
Gisela, go ahead, Patrick.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Si. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say we got to go to a break, Patrick. But
okay.
All right. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back after this. Gisela, thanks very much.
Catch Catholic Answers Live anytime at Catholic.com.
Behold Your Mother, a biblical and historical defense of the Marian doctrines by apologist and speaker Tim Staples is an apologetics tour de force, which delves deeper than ever before into the Catholic Church's teaching on our Blessed Mother, from her Immaculate Conception to the Annunciation, from her title as Mother of God to her perpetual virginity, from her Assumption into Heaven to her role as co-redemptrix. Tim gives you the facts and backs them up with solid biblical evidence in the way only Tim Staples can do. Call 1-888-291-8000, log on to Catholic.com, or visit a good Catholic bookstore in your area and get your copy of Behold Your Mother today. Now available in paperback and as an ebook. Get your copy today.
It might be said that anti-Catholic notions of the Church's history are the original fake news. With all the misinformation being spread, where does one look for the truth? In The Real Story of Catholic History, Professor Steve Weidenkopf gives you the facts on over 50 of the most common misconceptions about Catholic history and shows how to answer them simply and powerfully. Whether it's to answer claims about Catholicism's supposedly pagan origins, old myths about the Inquisition that never seem to go away, or more modern errors that anti-Catholics put forth, The Real Story of Catholic History is an essential resource for every Catholic's bookshelf. Order your copy of The Real Story of Catholic History today by calling 1-888-291-8000, visiting the shop at Catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Catholic Answers Live is brought to you in part by CatholicSingles.com, the website for Catholics who want to meet others who share their faith and values for faith, fellowship, and love. You can learn more at CatholicSingles.com. Catholic Answers Live thanks CatholicSingles.com for their generous support.
Call now with your question, 888-318-7884. This is Catholic Answers Live.
And welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, open forum. Any question you have on the life, the faith, the history of the Catholic Church, we are happy to take those questions. And this hour, Patrick Madrid is with us, the host of The Patrick Madrid Show and the author of many books, and also about to go to Ireland. You are on a pilgrimage to Ireland. Is it this week or next week, Patrick?
Yeah, we're coming up on that.
Should I check with Gisela on that one?
she would probably know. Yeah, we're looking forward to being able to visit the land of St. Patrick. It's going to be great.
Very, very good. Daniel, in Aurora, Illinois, listening on EWTN, your question for Patrick Madrid.
Yes. Hi.
Hi.
First-time caller. My question is, on the 1054 split with the Eastern Orthodox Church and the Catholic Church, every time I ask a friend from church, maybe a layperson, about Orthodox, they don't even know who they are. And my question is, why would people not know of the Orthodox Church when their church is doctrinally similar to the Catholic positions, especially on, like, scripture and tradition? So my question is, like, why wouldn't they know that? Because that would be a helpful tool for them when they're combating people of a Protestant faith.
Well, you know, we don't want to combat Protestants. They're our friends, and we want to win them over, not to do battle with them. So I might revise the language just a little bit that way. But I think I understand what you're saying. My guess is that the reason most Catholics in the United States don't know about the Eastern Orthodox churches is because they have virtually no contact with it. Some cities will have Orthodox churches. Many cities do not. Most Americans, they're just not. They don't see the Orthodox very often. So for that reason, I think they're just ignorant, not because they don't care about it. They just have never been exposed to it. Now, in Europe and in other parts of the country, it may be a different situation. But here in the United States, I think that's the fundamental reason why. Eastern Orthodoxy is a very small part of the overall picture in terms of the number of Christians in the United States, the number of Catholics. By comparison, the number of, say, Greek Orthodox or Russian Orthodox is much, much, much smaller. So your chances of running into an Eastern Orthodox believer is, in most places, pretty rare. I think that's why.
Well, because, like, even in books that I've read, whenever someone would be trying to explain a doctrine or explain an answer, like, such as sola scriptura and why scripture alone is not actually true, in a sense, and how come tradition along with it, sacred tradition along with it, should be, mm-hmm. you know, added to the whole concept, but Protestants don't believe that, but the Eastern Orthodox do, and they study that, but the thing is when I hear it or read it in a book, from a Catholic book or any other book in a Western perspective, they don't even bring up the Orthodox. And that's the point that I'm making is that they're separate from us. They're a schism, but what it means is that they're close to us in the sense of ideology, in the way that it would probably be a little bit easier to explain that to a person if we brought it to their attention.
Right. And I don't disagree with your point there. In fact, in my books, I wrote a book, for example, called Pope Fiction is one, but more specifically, Why Be Catholic. That book, I definitely bring in that specific issue. And I use it as a way of demonstrating, see, it's not just the Catholic Church that believes in apostolic tradition or scripture and tradition in the church. The Eastern Orthodox believers also believe in this. And the reason for that is, prior to the 11th century, as you mentioned, we were all together in the Catholic Church. And this grievous split that took place is a very big scandal. But nonetheless, they go back to the very beginning, the very time of the apostles, with us, because they were along with us in the Catholic Church for those first 10 centuries. So it is a very good historical argument, Daniel, and I agree with you on that point. I was trying to answer your earlier question, which is, how come Catholics don't seem to know about this? I think they're two separate issues. I wish more Catholics understood the affinity that we have with the Eastern Orthodox believers. But just because there's so little interaction with them, I think that's the practical reason why.
Okay, Daniel.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you. Thanks very much. Brian in Bangor, Maine, listening on Presence Radio. You are on with Patrick Madrid. What's your question, please?
Yes, I appreciate you taking my call. Love the show.
Thank you.
I'm reading my book. My question has to do with evangelization. I'm struggling a little bit with this on the balance. And I'm reading Cardinal Sarah's book, The Power of Silence. In it, he quotes Thomas Merton saying, "The inviolability of one's spiritual sanctuary, the center of the soul, depends on secrecy. Secrecy is the intellectual complement of pure intention." And then Cardinal Sarah says, "We could do so, latter with the grace." I'll start from the beginning. "It is disastrous if we want to find God in our souls and to remain there with him, to try to communicate him to others as we see him. We could do so later with the grace that he gives us in silence and by the influence and transparency of our life. True witness is expressed by the silent, pure, radiant examples of the sanctity of our life." And so I guess I'm struggling a bit with, when it comes to evangelization and kind of going over that border, and that in reading this book, it's really kind of hit home with me.
Okay. Would you like me to comment on that?
Yeah, I would like you to. Yes, I would. I would like you to kind of help me understand on evangelization in general and you know, dealing with people of other faiths, whether they're Hindu, Buddhist, and Protestant, and so forth. And also, when we're asked to talk about our personal relationship with Jesus, because essentially Cardinal Sarah is saying and giving examples where that's crossing a line. It's so mm-hmm. so it seems with him.
Gotcha. Well, let me begin with a preamble saying that I'm a very big admirer of Cardinal Robert Sarah, and I just really value the insights that he's shared with us. I have not read the second book that you're referring to. I have read, though, God or Nothing, his first book in English, anyway, that I've read. And so I'm deeply impressed with him. And my sense from reading that book is that what he's saying that in the quote that you mentioned is, you can't really share Jesus, you can't really share the Lord with people if you don't first know him in the silence of your own heart, in your own prayers and receiving the sacraments and pondering this beautiful love that he has for you. If you don't have that, at least at some rudimentary level, you can't really share it with anybody else. I think that's what he's driving at. I don't get the sense from anything I've read from him in this first book that I mentioned that he would even suggest that you shouldn't talk about Jesus with people, you shouldn't share God with people. But he's emphasizing that to be truly effective, you have to know him first. I think that's what's going on there.
Okay.
Thanks, Brian.
Does that ring true for you?
After you, if you read the book, because it's not the only time he references that, and obviously the book, The Power of Silence, it's all about that. It's all about sacredness of having Jesus in your heart, and how vulnerable and how precious that is, and to keep that secret. So I'm not complete. I understand what you're saying, and I agree 100%. You can't possibly communicate something that you don't have.
Right.
But that's not what I'm reading or interpreting at all. I'm interpreting that if you do have that, you need to keep it secret. And so it's still a little confusing. I'll keep digging at it.
Gotcha.
I appreciate what you're saying, and I understand that.
I'll just mention one other thing, because I think maybe you've illuminated me a bit further. Again, because I haven't read the book, it wouldn't be fair for me to try to comment on it, directly. But my sense is that he's referring to, and maybe you and I are talking about two different things. The one is, as you just said, you can't really share the Lord with others if you don't know him yourself. And we do have an obligation, a duty to share him with others. But I think you're referring more to that interpersonal relationship with Jesus at the level of your conscience, that walled garden of your very soul, where you and the Lord communicate directly face to face, so to speak. That's kind of a different area from what I was trying to emphasize, but I see your point.
Brian, thanks very much for that call. As you can hear, we are at the top of the hour. Patrick, something I did forget to mention, you are one of the great Catholic Twitterers out there.
Some people call me a twit.
Well, no, I don't believe that. At Patrick Madrid, right? I think you have one for your show, but at Patrick Madrid is the place to...
At Patrick Madrid. I love to interact with people on Twitter at Patrick Madrid.
How many followers? Do you have any idea now?
I don't know. I think it's up in the 40,000s or something like that.
There you go.
Somewhere up there.
Yeah, I'm almost there. I think I have 40.
That's peanuts compared to the big people.
All right. Next hour, Tim Staples will be in here. We'll do open forum again. So if you're on the line, stay on the line. If you haven't dialed, 888-318-7884, the number. Patrick Madrid, thank you so much, and have a wonderful trip to Ireland.
Thank you, and God bless you.
You too.